Now the program in which listeners' letters are treated to the feminine point of view, and it's called Petticoat Line. And the four women on the panel are Sheila Van Dam, Margaret Powell, Judy Innes, and Rennie Houston. In the chair, Anona Wynn.
Hello there, and welcome again to another Petticoat Line. As you know, we discuss problems sent in by listeners, and I'm starting off with one from someone who obviously prefers to remain anonymous. She writes, "My husband is in an important position, so naturally I invite people in. I prepare a very nice buffet, and as I come from the north, I go all out to make people welcome. Some of them say, 'Oh, you must come and see us,' but no date is ever mentioned. I've asked the same people back again, but still, their invitations are not forthcoming. Could it be because I do things too well for them to compete?" Rennie.
First of all, her husband's an important position. What a conceited remark to make. Isn't everybody's job in this world important, no matter what it is? Whether it's sweeping up leaves or talking a lot of tripe on Petticoat Line. It is. It's a terrible thing, too, that anybody would invite people to their homes and expect an invitation in return. Surely the greatest joy in life is giving, not receiving. Besides, I think it's a terribly conceited thing that she says altogether. She does things so well. How does she know how everybody else does it? Well, I mean, she couldn't, could she, Nonnie, if she hadn't been invited? I can always remember when I was young, when my grandmother invited anyone to tea. It was always the usual tea, boiled ham and tomatoes and cakes and everything else. And whoever came to tea would say, "Oh, my, you shouldn't have bothered." And my granny used to say, "It's no the bother, dear, it's the expense."
Oh, Rennie, that's absolutely lovely. Now, Sheila Van Dam.
She refers to them as people, of course, which is a little difficult. She doesn't refer to them as friends, because we must all assume, therefore, she hasn't got any. Mustn't we? Because she says people, doesn't she, in this question?
Invite people in, yes.
Well, you know, what does this cover? Well, if it covers her friends, normally if you invite your friends in, and they normally invite you back.
Now we come to a newcomer to Petticoat Line, Margaret Powell, who has written those very interesting books about below the stairs and coming up the stairs, and what do you do if you meet an escalator? Margaret, now, what is your opinion about this?
Well, personally, I think she tries too hard. I mean, she strikes me as the type of woman who's read all the books on the subject, you know, Home and Beauty and How to Run Your House like Buckingham Palace. She probably doesn't ask neighbours in. She doesn't want people popping in and out the home, you see, because that would muck up the home. Well, now, if I go into a house and I'm invited to, and nothing ever goes wrong, I never ask them back because everything goes wrong when I ask anybody.
Oh, Margaret, I loved your Scottish accent.
I mean, it's all right providing food and all that, but most people, the kind of people that she would invite, I should imagine, are affluent enough to provide their own food. You don't come for that. You come for warmth and company and conversation and a feeling that you're wanted. And obviously they don't get it there, because if they did, if they wanted to see her again, they'd ask her back. So it's not just the food.
Now we come to Judy Innes, who has been on the programme quite often before and, of course, as we all know, writes for the Daily Mail. Judy, dear, do you think you could say something nice about this poor lady who did write to us and want to know?
I know. I think she's probably shooting herself at this very minute. Yeah. Now, poor lady, I feel very sorry for her, because if you think of her from the point of view of her own psychology. She's obviously one of these people who slave away the whole night before, you know, cooking everything, polishing everything, ironing everything, tidying up, telling her husband, don't you touch that, don't you move this. So by the time the guests finally arrive, she's worn out, she's got bags under her eyes, she's had her hair done, but the set's come out because of all the cooking and the slaving. And all she can find to say when the guests arrive is, you jolly well better enjoy yourselves. But actually, the thing that amazes me, in fact, is that the guests don't ask her back, because I think one of the most sad things about a lot of people's social lives, particularly in this kind of set, is that a whole kind of dance grows up, you know. We have to have you to dinner tomorrow, so you've got to ask us back to dinner next week. We don't like you, you don't like us, but we've got to do it because otherwise we wouldn't have anything to do in the evenings except stare at each other.
I think perhaps we've all been a little bit tough on this lady. I'm going to comfort you. I'm going to say that possibly you are too anxious to please, and it does show. This does sometimes happen. Now, Mrs. Williams of London SE says, my husband and I always look on the Queen's Christmas speech as a part of our festivities. Now it is being dropped. What says the Petticoat Lion on this? Sheila.
Shame, shame, shame. Christmas will not be the same for me, certainly. I think it's like so many things that are happening today in this country. So many of the things that really mattered that have got to go by the board. I wonder whose decision it was, because only recently when the Queen did this fantastic The Royal Family film on television, which I thought was absolutely out of this world, it was so marvellous.
Marvellous.
And then it was said that she would then make the sort of speech that one would now expect, having seen this marvellous human being with this enormous sense of humour, that Prince Philip would be writing the speech or something, and she would now make a human speech. And I was really looking forward to this. Mm. I'd like to know who said no. I gather from listening this morning to something that they don't want it in the Commonwealth. Yeah. Who's the Commonwealth now? Anybody let me know? Yeah. What have we got?
You know, well, I'm common, but I've got no wealth.
We'll go over to Margaret Powell, who might have some ideas about this,
She has
strong ideas about everything.
I wonder if anybody's ever thought that maybe the Queen herself is mightily relieved she hasn't got to speak on Christmas afternoon. I can quite see her sitting there thinking to herself, there they are, that vast unseen audience, stuffed up with food and drink, and they're just sitting down listening to me because they've got to stop doing something for half an hour, so they might as well listen to me as not. I think this is a very sad thing that one should look upon the Queen's speech as a bore, because she works terribly hard to create understanding, not only amongst us, but amongst other people as well. And so if it's going to be looked upon as that, then I think we might just as well not listen to it and let us listen to her on the occasions when we want to hear her and she wants us to hear her. Perhaps you think it's all wrong to say this for Christmas Day, but you have to realise that this is a world now in which the younger generation have an ever-increasing say in things, and they don't want
to. Yes, more's the pity.
It doesn't matter.
Now, Judy, you're the youngest here, and you have your ear to the young ground. Tell us, do you think that this is a good thing, or it would have been a bad thing to go on doing the Christmas speech?
Well, I think, in fact, that Margaret was right when she said that a lot of young people do find it a bore, not because they find the Queen a bore, because I think everyone has enormous admiration and respect for her. Most people do, because they know how hard she works. But because of the whole trend, even in interviews on television, is towards greater informality. And the royal family showed that they understood this when they allowed this marvellous film to be made. And I think that was why it was so enormously popular, because it showed them as people. Mm. When I have watched the Queen on Christmas Day, I don't always, it's always seemed to me that she's not as at home and as easy as she was in the film, you know, with her family, surrounded by them, chatting, informal. And she didn't therefore come across as well.
But why does it have to be televised? Why can't we have it that we listen and Mum in the kitchen taking out the remains of the turkey? Why can't it be like phoning up a friend and just wishing them a Merry Christmas? Yeah. Rennie!
I would not have it otherwise. You say you like spending the Christmas with your family. She is our family. She's the head of our family. Our responsibility to her is terrific. I will certainly miss it because I'm a red-hot royalist and we are the greatest monarchy in the world. And God bless us.
Would it have been too much to ask the young just for, what, 3.5, 4, 5 minutes at the most, just to stop thinking about themselves and the world revolving entirely around them, just for 5 minutes?
But was
for
it
once,
the young?
365 days in the year, and listen.
But was it? She was it, in fact, in response to a great petition from all the young of the country that they formally decided to drop it. I don't think it
no,
was.
No, none of us really know, and maybe Margaret's right, maybe she wanted to bow out. Anyhow, there we are. Most of our audience that are present physically seem to think it's a pity, and perhaps a good many of those who are listening will feel that way too. It's been decided now, anyway, I suppose. Now, Mrs. Kay of Streatham says, I am a woman of 60, and I spent 10 years of my early youth in domestic service. I often wonder if the young women of today who turn their backs on and their noses up at this kind of work are all that much happier than we were. Does the Petticoat Line have any opinion on this? Now, we've saved this question, which came in a few weeks ago, because we knew we were going to have Margaret Powell, who can tell us all about what it was like below stairs. And what it's like now you've got your nose onto the top landing, dear? Tell us.
Believe me. Now I'm in the affluent society, it's smashing. I wish I'd got there earlier. The thing is, of course, when you get to be 60 and older, you look back upon when you were young, and any time when you were young was a damn sight happier than what it is when you're 60, believe me. I mean, look at all the things you could do.
I'm only 3 years off 70, and I'm still young and enjoying myself.
You lie, no talking about me. No, I don't think people are any happier. In proportion to the amount of things that they have now, right from when they're very young, when they start school, and when they grow up and they become teenagers, in proportion to the affluent life they have now and that we had, they are not happier for it. But then one can't say that they're less happy. I mean, I had a miserable life in domestic service. One had to work all the hours there were for very little money and hardly any freedom. But I wasn't miserable all the time. How can you be? When you're 15 and 16 and 17, you've got all the resilience of youth. It's impossible to be miserable all the time. You are happy. I mean, you can look round, of course. I mean, I looked at them upstairs and saw what far better life they had than I got. But now I'm joining them upstairs, believe me. I don't know how to be.
Just before we pass on, what do you do for domestic help?
Me? I wouldn't have one to save my life.
In other words, you know too much about what goes on.
Yes.
Judy?
Well, I think obviously people have a certain amount of capacity for happiness and unhappiness. And some people can be miserable no matter how delicious their surroundings, and other people can be happy no matter how awful. But one thing I would say is that nobody that I know enjoys doing housework. And the housewives I know, even the housewife ones, they say, well, you know, I get a feeling of satisfaction when the house is clean and when it's looking spotless. But if you say, and, you know, do you actually enjoy doing it, they arrange their lives to get through it in the quickest possible time. And although, you know, a girl probably could be happy at times, although she was spending her entire life doing nothing but housework in somebody else's house, bossed about, having to get up at 6:30, not allowed to go out with her boyfriends in the evening very often, one day off. How many days off, Margaret?
One afternoon, even a week, from 4:30 to 9:30, and the same amount alternate Sundays.
But what would they get now? Of course, now you have...
Well,
now
they lay the red carpet down
for
you.
Yes, well, there you are.
Well, there was a job advertised the other day. Kitchen maid, £7 per week, own room, television, liberal outings, one child not objected to. In other words, they're saying they know you haven't got a father, but we don't mind, you see. Yes, I mean, if such a... There was always the dread that you were flighty. Flighty girls got illegitimate babies and you got the sex straight away with no reference.
Now they have you in, with
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they welcome you, baby. Oh, yes, oh, yes.
And yet they still turn their backs on it today. Rennie.
During the war, I must tell you a funny story, darling. During the war, Margaret, we needed help and I got a little daily girl to come in. And then she thought she liked the place, and I said, I would like you to live in. She says, well, I'll think about it. So she came to live in. And she says, now, what will you want me to do? I said, well, first of all, I'm out late at the theatre at nights, darling, if you bring me a cup of tea in the morning. So she came in the following morning with a tray with a teapot, put it on my lap and says, there you are. How does it feel to be a lady? As though I'd never had it in my life before, you see. I caught her washing the kitchen floor, standing up, just bending. I said, no, darling, you can't do that. You've got to kneel down to do it properly.
She had housemaid me.
After I'd been down on my knees for 10 minutes, she said to me, you've left that little bit over there.
Sheila, follow that.
I can't possibly follow that. If one's trying, I don't think I can answer this even seriously. There's no doubt in what, it must have been in the 1920s, near enough. I've been doing some sums, I think. And I suppose it was an accepted thing and quite a thing to be in one of these rather gorgeous households, I imagine, and to work your way up to be a house parlourmaid. And the one thing I can only think is that certainly then they had security, 100% security. I mean, I'm not saying...
Where that from?
Well, from what do you start at? You tell me, darling. What was it?
A house parlourmaid.
Well, don't you work your way up to that?
Well, no,
didn't
not
you start
really.
In the kitchen?
You all have your allotted places in the hierarchy of servants.
Yeah, but
you know.
Didn't you work your way from the bottom to the top?
Oh, no, if you start in the kitchen, you end there.
But didn't you become a house parlourmaid?
Never in this world.
And then you got up to be a cook.
Oh, yes. A cook with a kitchen maid, eventually.
But, you know, from what I've heard you, I've not read your book, but I have heard you talk a lot, on interviews, and it seemed to me the greatest snobbery was amongst the people in service themselves to each other, wasn't it?
Well, you're quite right, Anona, there, because snobbery didn't exist amongst them upstairs because they even weren't aware of our existence at all. So, obviously they knew somebody kept the house in spick and span, but, I mean, until you got right up in your own domain, you had your own separate back staircase. You weren't even allowed to pollute theirs. But the hierarchy amongst servants is very, very high indeed. And, I mean, starting off with the housekeeper, who is as much as a bugbear to servants as the lady herself. But in my first place as a kitchen maid, the kitchen maid is the lowest of everyone, because not only does she have to wait on them upstairs, she has to wait on the servants as well. And in my first place as a kitchen maid, I wasn't even allowed to eat with the servants. Had to have mine out in the kitchen by myself.
Oh, man's inhumanity to man and woman's inhumanity to woman. Well, dear lady of Streatham, I'm afraid the consensus of opinion is that it's much happier not to be doing what Margaret went through at the time. Now, here we come to a very serious question. We've all been shocked and frightened by reports of conditions in our mental and geriatric hospitals. The excuse for lagging behind in improvement is always given as lack of money. But successive governments go on pouring out hundreds of millions helping other countries. The United States of America, with its own slums and problems, does the same thing. Does the Petticoat Line think any government has the right to send our money away before our people are decently treated and housed? Judy.
Well, I know this is going to be very unpopular because, you know, there's no saying that people like so much as charity begins at home. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just as possible to be selfish as a nation and far more dangerous as it is to be selfish as a person. And look, we're so lucky. I know, right, there are terrible things still wrong with this country. But compared to a lot of countries in the East, in Africa and South America, we are so lucky. And to refuse to share is not only, I think, wicked, but also very silly because it's self-defeating. So I think we should send money.
You do.
Yes, I do.
Rennie?
You think you should send money before you see to our own hopeless cases that are not well looked after and our nurses who are so underpaid and everything else? No, darling, I don't. You're putting it just like robbing Peter to pay Paul. If we see to our own country and our own dear people, first of all, let us give what we can spare afterwards.
Sheila?
I'm very much on Rennie's side here. You know, I suppose there are a million reasons why, which I can't understand, we should send money to other countries, but I feel, as I'm sure all of us feel, that it should be here first, and not only in the homes for the aged, but also in some of the hospitals.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it seems to me this is where the money should be spent, and if you're talking about America and you're talking about the astronauts, it seems to me they could have spared a bit instead of going to the moon.
Margaret Pearl.
Well, I look upon this problem as one that affects our kind of image abroad to a very large extent. Now, isn't the whole problem that years ago, these vast continents of Africa and India and South America, when we owned them all, they were our milk cow, and we milked them for all we possibly could. We took money from them. We made ourselves wealthy at their expense. And now I think we should feel guilty about the poverty that is in these countries. We should help them. You can't take it all in one age and never give anything back in the other. Not if you want to respect yourself anyway.
Thank you. Margaret, may I just say that having, you know, lived quite a bit in Asiatic, not Africa, countries, one way or another, I would like to say that we left Singapore, there was no rubber, that was grown here. We took it, you know. They had fever-infested islands. They made each other slaves. We put an end to that. We taught them how to do the tin mining, and it was all paid for by the British taxpayer. We took some money out, but we left a lot behind. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I find that the very wealthy people, if I may also wind up this, there are a lot of very rich people, millionaires with gold-plated beds and motor cars. Why don't they give to their own poor occasionally? I think this would be a good idea, too. There we are, you see, isn't it lovely? We're so divided and so argumentative and it's good. Now, Mr. Haywood of Nottingham writes, "Dear girls..."
Oh, me.
"It has been," he said, "and is my pleasure to know a representative cross-section of females, but none who has been christened Bettine, Juno, or a Nona, nor even a Rennie or a Fanny. Have all these four names been taken for professional reasons? And if not, do you consider that given names can assist a career? Ought people to change their names to the more likely to succeed names? Now, what," he says, "if Winston Churchill had been called Nosmo Claphanger?" "Does the Petticoat Line think he would have been the same success?" Rennie.
Yes, of course he would. God rest his soul. He was wonderful, and he would have been still as big a success if they'd called him Jimmy McGittrigan.
You don't think the name matters?
No, no. I do think the name matters when it's Well, I mean, if I'd stuck to my own name and my sister had stuck to hers, there'd have been no room for anybody else's name on the bill.
What was it, then?
I was christened Katharina Valerita Veronica Murphy Gribben. And my sister Billy was christened Sarah Cecilia Maria McMahon Gribben. So there'd have been no room for an owner, winner, or any of the rest of them if we got on the bill.
There am I with my nice little neat name, but I have got Edna in the middle. I can't think of myself as an Edna. Sheila, dear, do you think that names are important and people can take names which alter their careers?
Yes, there's no doubt that it assists in a career where there's some doubt of the talent to start with. Now, I'm really talking about pop singers who luckily today they start with nothing but a very long name, and I'm sure we're all thinking about the same young man, and he started with nothing but a name really and good looks, but he has learned his job, and best of luck to him, you know, he has made it, but he wouldn't have made it under the name of Jerry Wilson or whatever it was.
He did have another name before he became Engelbert Humperdinck. Thank you.
Engelbert, so therefore, in his case, of course it helped.
Margaret.
Well, I certainly think that, as Sheila said, that if you have got talent, you're going to come on top, whatever your name is. But mind you, I think you've got to work harder at it. I mean, I often think of Winston Churchill. He must have been called Winnie at school, mustn't he? Well, if you're called Winnie and you've got no talent, believe me, you're very soon to find out. He survived being called Winnie, so he must have been marvellous. But it reminded me of a little episode when I was a cook. We had a parlour maid whose name was Theodora. Well, I mean, absolutely unheard of for domestic servants to have names like Theodora. She was the parlour maid, and she managed to marry the son of the house.
Oh.
Now, of course, this rather riled me, because after all, I was the cook and the waiter. Stomach, but of course the fact was she was very good looking, you see, and I was as plain as could be. So the very fact that, I mean, the way to his stomach obviously wasn't the way to his heart, unfortunately. So I do think that she did have a great asset in Theodora.
Theodora.
I wish my mother had called me that.
You know. Margaret obviously cooked those sort of meals and invited those sort of people that didn't want to invite her back.
I had to marry the milkman. And Joe was lucky to get in. I thought I'd had it almost, believe me. I mean, the scarcity of young men was so terrible, I thought I'd had it once or twice.
And he didn't mind what you were called. Now, I think Theodora would really, that would catch the eye a bit. Judy.
Sheila's right, you know. It gives, obviously, people in certain areas, particularly the entertainment world, a head start to have a name that people can remember. But on the other hand, I know an awful lot of people who don't need it. After all, think of Tom Jones. You couldn't have a plainer name than that.
It wasn't his name, was it, originally?
He's changed it to one that's so plain and simple.
He's a gorgeous bit of work,
isn't
he?
I know, exactly. He should need a name.
Anyway, I think I can tell Mr. Haywood that all of those that he mentioned were christened. We didn't change our name. I know I was christened and brought up as an Anona, and I think Bettine and Juno and Rennie, that... No, did you take... Was Rennie anywhere in it?
Houston was my mamma's maiden name. Was she married?
Were you a Rennie?
No, Katharina was a corruption of that.
Oh, I see. You got
but
to that.
I just wanted somebody to know I've kept it to myself all along, including you. Sheila Van Dam is sitting next to Mrs. Van Wintermuther.
Don't stop getting talking.
Yes, my Donald was Donald Stuart Van Wintermuther.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. Well, I can understand why you don't want that on the billing. The Radio Times could never get it in. Well, it's time to wind up now. I don't think we've solved anything, but we've given our opinions, which are just like those of those... the audience here and the audience who are listening, able to be discussed later on, get a good laugh, and perhaps it's made you think. You've been listening to Rennie Houston, Sheila Van Dam, Margaret Powell, and Judy Innes. Next week's panel will be Rennie Houston, Charmian Innes, the Inneses are doing rather well, Sheila Scott, and Anne Shelton. And this is Anona Wynn saying goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Petticoat Line is devised by Ian Messiter and Anona Wynne and produced by Christopher Searle.